No ideas? How many of you aren't going to answer regardless of what I ask? Would you put up your hands, please? Thank you. Source? Does it tell you something of truth? What else? Nothing comes to mind? Anything come to mind?
God.
God? Why? Beautiful. And what is the mantra you use? It's beautiful. And what does that mean to you, God?
What does it mean to God?
What does it mean to you? Yeah, but what does God mean?
God is
yeah. Thank you. That's very beautiful. Anybody else going to answer me? She said nothing else. I keep me having an answer. I appreciate hearing that. I'm not going to hear from anybody else. I don't think. Okay. You came here to be entertained. There are two different types of guru or teacher or lama. La means higher, ma means mother. All beings who mother the higher in you, the higher purpose, the higher understanding. One of them is called lineage guru. And that means where your guru, and then where he got his teaching from, his guru, and where he got his teaching from, his guru. So like whoever it was that introduced you to that meditation, and then whoever he learned it from, and then whoever would be the lineage guru. And of course in Buddhism, all of those stretch back to before recorded history, with names filled in and are chanted as if they were absolutely true, although there is no record of any of it. Just like every teaching, there is a mythological side to it as well, right? Does that make sense? And then there are root gurus, and root guru basically means the root of that understanding, the root of that learning, the root of that, the teacher who gave you the mantra. And the experience of that mantra would be the experience of God in your heart. The actual learning of how to do that would be a guru in Buddhist terms. The guru represents the person who has enough understanding to pass something on to someone who is seeking. So they are called the Lama, the mother of the higher. That is to say, they mother you into the experience of a higher state. It's quite lovely, isn't it, that differentiation, that language. A root guru is talking about a specific thing, like you could talk about your root guru for learning how to do subtraction in school. And that would be whoever taught you how to do subtraction in what grade 2 is that? Grade 3? Something like, huh? Is it? It's grade 1. There you go. So sometimes, so you would have a root guru for learning to subtract. You would, because that's a truth, not a truth. So, and that would be where it came from, you know, one who taught you something. You would have a root guru for making coffee. You'd have a root guru for taking photographs. Root guru for making a quick meal, whatever. There are all these different root gurus that arise. And when you're talking about to invoke the best frame of mind for the practice of meditation, recall the root gurus. You know that you've had many, many root gurus in your life. You're not only looking at the root gurus who inspire you spiritually, but you're also, if you're able to not be so fixed in such a small view, looking at inspiration. What?
Could be somebody who is in your life that I have this point in my life who's extremely wrathful and always raging and temper tantruming and being abusive, but you can just realize to do it. I can fix that. She's a real teacher for me. She is a wrathful beauty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the depth that she is, but she is.
Yeah.
So she was like a.
She would be the root guru for seeing anger in yourself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a big.
It is a big wow. And this is what you look at. When you look at the root gurus, even the little root gurus or the big root gurus, there is, watch out, listen. There is always this gap between 1 minute you don't get something and the next minute you get it. Isn't that true? When you're learning something, 1 minute you don't know it and the next minute you won't know it. That is the quality of a root guru. It isn't whether you like them or they like you. So it totally has nothing to do with good or bad or like or dislike. It has to do with your willingness to have all of your experiences to bring you to now stop right here. And everything in front of you be a possibility. It is that moment between asking a question and getting an answer. Because if you don't have that, there are no root gurus. Okay? Does that make sense? So when it says here to invoke the best frame of mind for the practice of meditation, recall the root gurus and experience their blessing. That is the blessing of a root guru. That what I call the first time you experience something. And it can be anything, because that state is without name. It isn't only with this person or only with that person. You think of the very first time you tasted a fresh cherry. This spring or in this life. Right? The first time you went picking salmon berries. Is this making sense to you? The first time you saw a grizzly. The first time you tasted peanut butter on toast. The first time you made love. The first time you made hate, if you remember. You getting it? That you look at those moments and you think, 1 minute that isn't there, the next minute there's a new understanding. And that moment between where you don't know, where you are the Polish mudra, where you have the interest, the question, you're present, you're aware, and then there is a leap. That space between those two is the quality of Root Guru. That's what you're recalling. So now you've learned that the usual ways you take refuge may or may not be refuge for you. You have learned one that is refuge. But there must be times also where you're not sure. Because I'm sure that it's true for almost everybody. So to actually practice looking at the root of your ability to have a new experience, with that passion as your practice, the perception will match that. Where there is a passion, there is a perception. Where there is a perception, there is a passion. Right? So this first paragraph is basically about how do you prepare yourself for meeting the divine. First recall the root gurus. The root gurus. And experience their blessing. What is the blessing of the root guru from 1 minute to the next? A new understanding. That aha. And the space between neither the new understanding as you or the not understanding as you, but that moment where you're flying between the two. That's the blessing. Where you let go of subject-object duality. There I say it. That's true, isn't it? You're exactly right with it. Absolutely. And in fact, that is the teaching. When you actually practice that way, exactly what you said, all beings are the Buddha, all places are nirvana, all sounds are the divine sound. Which is exactly what you were saying. And that is the point. That whenever you have to feel defensive or to catch up with or any of the three conceits, you are putting yourself in hell. When you actually start noticing that, then you want to practice refuge in a different way. Not based on I, but based on the relationship between I and not I. Not subject object. Cast all your votes for dead. And so then the next sentence says, this makes the mind, body, and the place of meditation divine and pure. Wouldn't you, if you practiced that, couldn't you just see everywhere you are as? And I'm saying, well, yeah. As soon as you do this, this makes the mind, body, and the place of meditation, whatever the meditation is, whether it's an active one or a passive one, divine and pure. But if you keep fishing into the past or casting into the future, you're not in the present. So you can't find that moment of jumping off the cliff. You know, the tarot fool, the tarot card of the fool, always falling over the cliff of unknowing into new understanding, always falling over the cliff of unknowing into new understanding, the divine fool. How can you do that? You're too busy nailing it down. You're going to get, oh, well, I should have done that, and I'm going to do this, or I'm never going to do this. I should have been. Isn't that true? There's the clinging to the past and future that doesn't bring refuge. To evoke the best frame of mind, you have to remember the root guru, that experience of a transcendent experience. Small t. I always think of it like having a sort of no-name brand of guru in front of me, like a statue, but with a little slot in top of their head, like a piggy bank. And I just go through all the different moments of firsts that I can come to. I just like you're putting these coins of experience in the top of his head until you look at it and you've just got this, you know, you look at a piggy bank often enough and put money in it, it starts to represent all that money. Well, guess what? You put all of the coins of verse into a no-name brand guru and call it root guru, it's going to represent first. Because when you realize that passion and perception are tied together, you can start using them. I mean, at the moment, all our advertising uses passion and perception, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And we all know that. But we never think of using it on ourselves in a more wholesome way, or very rarely. We like to think of ourselves as permanent, that's why. Don't we? As, you know, a fixed identity. I am this. Subject, object. I am this relationship. So hang around in old age homes. Watch how memory and relationship just starts going down the drain. Just watch that for a while. Very interesting. Who am I if I'm not here? How I like to think of myself is not here. This is a good question. It's nice to have thought about it before it happens, so maybe you can keep awareness without an object. At the moment, we depend on an object to maintain our awareness, don't we? But how can you... It's wonderful to train your mind on an object, but anything that is truly refuge has to transcend any I. So if I am caught up in an experience that transcends I, and that doesn't mean it's separate from at all. If I'm caught up in an experience with something that transcends I, the referencing mind will be so overwhelmed, how will I maintain my focus? I'll probably just swoon out or something. With fear or habituation or... So how to take the holy states and keep them conscious? That's basically, in Buddhism, called meditation.
So then really you don't have to, I'm always beating myself up because I don't have this meditation practice all the time. So if you think that if we do this,
it is a discipline in itself. It will be highly aided if you maybe can't do a full meditation of more than 10 minutes. But everybody can do 10 minutes. The truth is, you can do 10 minutes. You can just not stop to have that, you know, cup of tea or piece of toast, or, you know, because you know you can grab one later. Means you will have to drop another habit. Jeez, to create a new habit. Gosh. Do you understand what I'm saying? Everybody can do 10 minutes. And if you do the 10 minutes of not having your usual activity, it will really feed your ability to hold this focus during the day. Other than that, this whole thing will just become an idea that you have in your intellectual album of perceptions. And when it's the appropriate time, it will come forward as if you actually knew it. Does that make sense? You know, it's one thing to know something intellectually, it's another thing to make room for it to manifest in your life. 10 minutes a day, don't make it more, don't make it less. Doesn't matter whether you're restless sitting there or your mind keeps thinking, come on, sit for those minutes. Just, you know, get up 5 minutes earlier and go to bed 5 minutes later. You got 10 minutes more somewhere in the day. right?
No.
Damn. Damn, Cecily. Well, you're right, but I'm not sure I can fit it in. You don't have to hold to it, you just have to do it the day you're in. That's all. And if you don't do it, you say, oh, I missed it. Oh, well, I'll do it tomorrow. And if you do it, don't do it 3 days in a row, you say, okay, I'm going to take 3 more days off, and then I'm going to start on this day. And you start again. But the important thing is that you keep your word to yourself.
When I don't, it turns around.
Yeah, so what you do is you take 3 days off and you say, okay, this is when I'm going to start. And it's also, as I've said before here, very useful to tell everybody that you're going to do it and what time you're going to do it. I mean, everybody. People at the corner store.
You're fine.
I mean, everybody, because the moment that you feel like not doing it, you'll walk out the door instead because there's something you just have to do first, and you will meet one of those people, and they'll go, are you doing your whatever, prayer, meditation, whatever you tell them? Have you stopped doing that? And you go, thank you. And you turn around and you go back. You don't have a discussion with them. But if you don't do that, you're like, it's too easy for us to sort of just start sliding over the lines, because it's just 10 minutes. If I miss it, it's not important. But that's more important for me to do, right? You understand?
Yes.
So it's like the habit is very important. And the consistency in the habit is more important than length. So you don't do an hour one day because you feel good about it. You're going to do 10 minutes, you do 10 minutes. You're really hungry to do one 10 minutes, keep doing 10 minutes. When you know you really would like to do more, then put it up to 20. When you're really hungry to do more, it's amazing how your life starts adjusting around that. Pretty soon, like 30 is no time at all. God, I'm just barely. And because you have made it consistent, you have habituated yourself to doing it every day. So like you're training yourself how to use habit for what you want. I'm saying there's nothing in what I've been saying about refuge or habituation that is not usable. Every part of our being is exactly what we need. It's how we're using it that is the question. If you keep trying to cut a loaf of bread by holding the blade as the handle and the handle as the blade, your hand gets really sore, there's lots of red fluid all over the room, and the bread won't cut. Same tool, use it differently. Ta-da! Isn't that true? We're not missing anything. It's just how we're using it. So there. So that's that first paragraph. Does that make sense to you now, what that's talking about? That's what it's saying. To invoke the best frame of mind for the practice of prayer or meditation, recall the root gurus and experience their blessings. This makes the mind, body, and the place of meditation divine and pure. Isn't that nice? Second, acknowledge the clarity of mind known as awareness. Realize the good fortune bestowed by this clarity. Do you see that by clearly seeing what you have been using as refuge and then clearly choosing a refuge that you would like to use, is a blessing? Do you see by watching your perception change with a passion, or passion change with a perception, how that can make you more, that the clarity of the mind that can see that can make you less fearful and less self-concerned and more aware of all beings? How beautiful that life is the very best of all the gurus. Life is the most profound teacher we have. All the beings around us, not just a few. Every being is like so precious to each of us. So precious. When you're thinking this way, that what is important for me to develop what we would call objectivity, but I don't think that's a good word, clarity. Where you can have great devotion and you can have clarity. Because objectivity is so tinged with this idea of no devotion, isn't it? As if somehow if your heart is involved you can't see clearly. I don't think that's true. Your heart can be involved, your views can be involved, and you can also see clearly if you choose it. There is that part of ourselves that is always able to see the screen if we wake up enough to choose it. Isn't that true? You know that sometimes you've just suddenly seen something, like you said about your client. Nothing changed, your sense of liking or disliking her doesn't change. But your clarity about seeing what was the opportunity of that relationship. Realize the good fortune bestowed by this clarity. Realize that with clarity you can see when there is suffering, when there is satisfaction. And you can start examining with clarity what makes this dissatisfactory, what makes this not. So you don't continuously repeat unwholesome patterns, hoping that soon you'll be good enough to be released from them. Don't take out the stitches, just give the garment to somebody in the past, buy a new one. So how? So that is also a freedom. There's nothing we're missing and nothing we're fated to, except coming to a full appreciation of loving kindness and compassion in this world. Eventually, life is going to teach all of us that. Eventually, all of us are coming to that point. There's no question. Why? Because it feels bad. And we prefer to feel good. Number one, when you're doing this thing called chanting the numbers in Buddhism, is what is the one? Number one, all beings live by nutriment. What is another one? Number one, all beings desire happiness. Isn't that nice? Because all beings desire happiness, the experience of coming to a full opening of not only relative truth, but absolute truth, and then the non-differentiation of the two, or I and thou, and then the non-differentiation of the two as a total experience, is the only thing that's going to happen to any of us. If you're talking about karma, if you're going to say, that's my karma, I will agree with you if you say transcendence is your karma. Anything else, I'm going to quibble. But it is the karma of all conscious beings. No one is left out. No being is left out. Amoebas, lice, Why? Because all beings desire pleasure. The pain-pleasure reflex habituates us to pleasure. To do something twice, you survive. You avoid the pain. So we will repeat those habits that we've done before until we bring clarity into it. Is that straightforward? Do you want me to go further? Is that enough for today? You feeling stuffed or? What do you think? Yeah, just a couple of you are getting that glazed look. So we'll take over from there tomorrow. Those are yours, by the way. They're written in very Buddhist language, but I in my experience, they're written in the language of every teaching. It's just a matter of substituting the words that are more comfortable. So, any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Out. What's there? Where does the consciousness go?
And that's the question.
Yeah.
So like that's the question that you have a passion for and you have all your experience up to here.
Mm-hmm.
But don't you let your experience color what you think is the answer? A la with your bank card.
Mm-hmm.
That is the question. So if you put the passion, that's the focus. When you want to evoke the best frame of mind for the practice of meditation or prayer, you need a really good question and you need a really good passion, right? So that you're directing how you want to go. You're not just doing the habitual stories based on like and dislike that we all do all the time. Is this a clear summary of what I've been teaching all day? Yeah. So rather than be caught in habituation in our usual refuge, which is based on like and dislike, which is a reflex reaction from amoebic stage, we're actually using the understanding that the self is not necessarily what I like or dislike,
mm-hmm.
right? And that, in fact, it's just a reaction. And that I do have other options, right? And so, how would I like to use this question?
Mm-hmm.
Question is, who am I when I'm not involved in a subject-object relationship? And then you can think, okay, well, what times have I not been involved in a subject-object relationship? Right? So what comes to mind? Passing out, yeah. What else? Yeah, that's a good one. What else? Ever had an orgasm?
Mm-hmm.
To happen then? Hard to remember, but pay attention.
Yeah.
Is there subject object just for a moment at orgasm? There is not.
Yeah.
There is not. Ever sneezed?
Mm-hmm.
Again. Same. Yawn?
Yeah.
Yeah, same. Are you falling into deep sleep? Okay. So like in the traditional Buddha Tibetan way of looking at it, there are four times where you have a clear experience of consciousness without object. One is orgasm, one is sneezing, one is yawning, and one is going to sleep. Unfortunately, you're not, you know, sneezing is a very short one, and it's really hard to be conscious in it. Have you noticed? I think it was yawning. It could have been hiccuping. I think it was yawning. And there's just a moment where you actually have to let go and just let the yawn take over. And just for that second, there is no subject-object doctrine. Again, it's very, very short. And falling asleep, it's not so inspiring to see that. So you see all these Buddhist pictures from the Tibetan where you got a guy and a woman doing it, you know? Like, what are they pointing at? They're pointing at a state where subject and object are not separate. Non-dual consciousness. To be in that state of union and conscious. Because like you could have religious paintings in the Buddhist tradition of people sneezing. But I don't think so many people would get it. Or somebody yawning, you know. Great saying. You know, I mean, somehow I don't think it would have the same, you know. Or falling asleep. I don't, yeah, well maybe, you're pretty good. So somehow it's not as inspiring for that point. And so what you're evoking is a memory of. Is that clear? So they talk about that. They talk about the bliss of meditation. And there are experiences that are, I have had experiences in practice, in meditation practice, that transcended any orgasm experience I have ever had with a partner. And I was not shy about exploring that venue. Did like them, actually. It was a good way to forget everything, change the subject. My motto in those days was, when in doubt, fuck. You met me at the end of that, basically. And I know that when I actually started to practice and falling into that state of consciousness without object, conscious, but no subject object, it creates that upper spine and that bliss, what they call kundalini. That is a profoundly beautiful. And it is an indication of what happens when you lose your body, because there's still the body demand. So at the moment of death in Buddhism, they say that there is that experience, which they call the clear light of the void, of total non-subject. This energy. And so what you're practicing during your life with that prayer or anything like that is teaching yourself to hold a focus to an infinite quality. And is not separate from anything, but is not any separate thing. That makes sense? So teaching yourself to relate non-subject object. Because in the Buddhist tradition, the biggest problem we have when we die is that when we do experience the clear light of the void, it's so freaking awful to us because it just doesn't have your usual slippers or whatever, that you immediately freak out. And so you swoon. So you go into this faint swoon state for a period of time and then you come out of it. The time varies, They say 3 days, but it could be less than that or more than that. And then you can't remember that you died, because it's just you again. So you tend to go visiting everybody you knew. Especially if you have children or something like that. So it's also always useful if you have died and somebody that you're very close to understands that you might come around, if they tell you how well you did it and that you're dead now. Because there can be a lot of confusion at that point. Because that quality of habituation is very powerful. And to look beyond where you are is very difficult unless you practice bursting. You can have an image of who you think is going to be there when you die, but when you actually get there, that image might turn out to just have bad breath or something. So to practice that image with the way of opening to first, so that your perception, your expectations of what it should be remain an unknown, that's more like not using your habitual things by opening to non-habitual. Yes?
Well, I was just wondering if you practice meditation and resolve, with the length of the time if you want to be shorter than a person who, let's say, did not practice with habitual.
Yeah.
Longer?
The short answer is yes. Absolutely. That as soon as you experience what they call the clear light of the void, if you have done enough practice, you would recognize it and surrender and have what they call enlightenment experience or transcendent experience at that point, because you have the consciousness to totally accept it, not the habituation to knee-jerk you back, which is the whole point in the Buddhist tradition. The whole point is basically not whether or not there is a God, but what the heaven, hell, and earth is this. Because in Buddhism, belief is the engine. Faith, belief is the engine. And intelligence is the ability to set goals regardless of where the engine takes you to. So that when you aim for one goal and it isn't what you thought it was going to be when you get there, have any of you ever had that experience in your life? Then you have the intelligence to look at it and say, okay, what worked and what didn't. Do you understand that? But if you just go faith and then intelligence and then faith and then intelligence, you're going to go, oh, it must be true, oh, it must be true. Oh, it wasn't true, what did I do wrong? Oh, it wasn't true, what did... Your intellect is going to be used as a pickaxe for something or other, them, you, or the circumstance you met, or, you know, your great-grandmother because she, whatever, you know? Where intellect is very good at finding focus, isn't it? And devotion is very good at creating the possibility. You know, they say... Basically, you don't say, this is my language. They say devotion without intelligence is stupid. And intelligence without devotion never gets off the couch. And that's basically what this is saying, that to evoke the root guru and experience the blessing, is using intelligence and devotion together. And then recognizing the clarity of mind that allows you to do that, choose how to make devotion without, you know, a fixed view of what should be the answer. The intelligence creates the focus. Balancing devotion and intelligence. Faith without works is dead. Works without faith is dead. Faith without trying it out and seeing what happens. Intelligence. And works without faith. But both together, then you know how to steer. Oh, I'm going a little too far this way. You don't steer all one way and then say, oh, that was wrong. You steer all the other way. Say, oh, no. You sort of kind of go between them. Oh, my God, it's 5 minutes overtime. Any last-minute questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Do you notice this really beautiful gold light? Shines through your body. Tickling up your vertebrae. Down to your funny bone. And your legs, the neck, it pours out of your body in all directions, feels this free. The whole city will be gone. Between us, we'll be really putting on a vibe. The whole province of you. Goes into the earth, up into space. All of North America, all of the Northern Hemisphere. Shines out into space. Through the whole planet. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind. Just for a moment, it's temporarily assuaged, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is that suffering. That is. So thank you for your great compassion.
Thank you.
Pleasure. So we'll carry on with this little. Say I was born in a family with three girls and one boy. Let's say that that could be true, and the first sibling was not me. Say it was a girl who sort of developed the ability, say, to create alternate realities, because that worked real well for her. Say, and you know, and said she did that, and then the second one would come who would say, let's say that one would say have a real talent for transcending structure. You're just really brilliant at it. And then say I came along and I was really fascinated by what's between the cracks and how far can I go in there. Really, you know, really worked at that, say, if I was. Then, you know, the fourth one came along, and I don't know how you would, let's make that one a boy or something. And maybe it could be a boy. I mean, you know, three girls, probably enough time for a boy. And that one would come along and would have this, you know, continuous sense of you know, like very intelligent, very, very good heart, incredible, and like always like, wait a minute, how do I fit in? Wait a minute, how do I always aware of them, right? Let's say that was the growing up process, right? So then I would always have a tendency in my life to take refuge in looking for the crack. Does that make sense? That would be my interest. That would be really my interest. Where's the crack? In order to see the crack, I'd have to be pretty good at detail eventually. So I would develop this great love for just naming it right. I just want to name it right. And of course, because that would be my refuge, whenever I felt threatened, I would like just, you know, really like, okay, it's just right here.
Stop struggling! Quit leaving! I'm trying to show you something!
Does that make sense? Because you know people, like maybe you, that does that? So then I start trying to impress my refuge, you know, on the world. Because if the world agrees with me, then I can feel okay. I can feel like I am fulfilling what they call the eight worldly dharmas, or the four worldly desires, which are basically desire for comfort, satisfaction, comfort. Desire for material or positional, getting what one wants. Desire to be loved beyond reason would be good for openers. And the last